Okay, good morning. So the last two weeks, we discussed cases of apostasy, of converting out. Last week, in discussing the case of Brother Daniel and the Benjamin Shalit cases in Israel, we started to make the transition towards what does it mean to be part of the Jewish people, with the implications of what it might mean to come in. But this week and next week, we're going to talk about the questions of converting in. So this week, we're going to explore the varying evidence that we have in both in the Talmud and in the medieval period on as to the question of whether or not the Jewish people actually wants converts. Is this something that we want, right? Regardless of whether we value an individual convert overall, is that something we want, right? We're not a proselytizing religion in the way Christianity is, but do we want converts? And the second question, and the question we're going to deal with next week, is the issue of the command to love the convert. And specifically, we're going to focus, at least for half of next class, on the question of whether the existence of the command to love the convert has legal implication in terms of the standards we require to allow someone to convert. So that's the plan for the next 2 weeks. Okay. So today, like I said, what I want to do is explore the question of do we want converts? And to sort of capture this question, I want to read a painful passage to read. It's from the medieval period in Source 1. It's found in an article by Rami Reiner, who's a professor at Ben-Gurion University, where he records the following scene from 1096 in the First Crusade. So he writes that in the turbulent days of 1096, as Europe's clergy and nobility led the mobs in the First Crusade, a local drama unfolded in the German city of Mainz. In the words of the Jewish chronicler Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimshon, "So there was a very kind man named Mr. Yaakov, son of Sulam, and he was not descended from a high-ranking family, and his mother was not Jewish," meaning not born Jewish. "And he shouted loud and clear to all who were present thus, 'So far you have done nothing but disgrace me, and now behold what I shall do.' And he took the knife in his hand and thrust it into his own throat before all who were present and slaughtered himself in the name of the Almighty." So you have here a convert who martyrs himself. Right? Martyrdom was relatively common during the Crusades in Ashkenaz, in Germany, in France. But here you have a convert.
A convert or a child?
Sorry, it's a convert. I believe this is it's a convert. His mother's not Jewish. He's a convert. And he martyrs himself. But before he martyrs himself, he says to the Jews, "You've done nothing but disgrace me. And watch what I'm about to do." When he takes the knife, he plunges it into his throat, and he martyrs himself. Now, Reiner continues. He says, "In those days, public suicide as an act of Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, was a last resort for Jews who were forced to become baptized at the point of a sword." And this could be a serious in and of its own right, classic rabbinic literature before and after looks very askance at suicide, to say the least. And yet there was this culture not just of allowing yourself to be killed, but as this convert, Yaakov ben Sulam, did. He actually killed himself. He martyred himself. And that was something that happened a lot during the period of the Crusades. We have many records even of people killing not just themselves, but their family, their children, rather than have the family baptized. And that sort of painful period in Jewish history, and the question of whether that was even legitimate, is a topic for another time. But the reality on the ground was this was relatively common. But our chronicler provides details indicating that the drama at hand was likely triggered by somewhat different circumstances. Yaakov's lowly origins, He was born, oh no, so it was, he's, sorry, he's a second generation convert, right? He's not a convert, his mother. He was born of a convert mother and a father, so he's a generation, he's second generation convert.
He's a born Jew, correct.
He's a born Jew, but he's a child of a convert, and a father not descended from a high-ranking family had apparently caused him to suffer disgrace at the hands of Mainz Jews. The fact that he was a very kind man seems to have borne little, if any, weight against the hostile community. It seems, therefore, that Yaakov's public suicide was an act of defiance directed at his own community. If you continue, though, he says, describing events in the shadow of anti-Jewish persecutions that same year in another German city, in Zanten, the chronicler says, "And there was also a slave of God who was a Ger Tzedek," meaning a convert to Judaism, "and he asked Arai Moshe Kohen Gadol, saying, 'If I should slaughter myself in his great name, what shall become of me?' And the rabbi replied, 'You should dwell with us.' The convert is worried that his eternal reward, even if he sanctifies God's name, may not be guaranteed. Moreover, this convert is not identified by name, but as, quote, a slave of God who was a Ger Tzedek, who was a convert. Is this only coincidental, or did many converts of the period and the locality remain nameless and faceless in their death, and perhaps also in their lives?" So, Rami Reiner opens his article, the question of, does Jewish tradition want converts, encourage conversion, with these two painful stories from the medieval period, where he notes that it was clear that this convert, who's dedicated, right? We are bracketing it out, the question so far of, are converts, right? What about a convert who's not sincere? Here we're talking about a convert who is sincere, right? The paradigm of sincerity that was held up as the gold standard in the medieval period, the willingness to martyr yourself at the hands of the crusaders rather than be baptized. Here you have this child of a Jew, of a convert, right? A second generation convert, born Jew, but he's part of a convert family. So he's undeniably Jewish, he's undeniably committed, he's willing to put his life on the line and take his own life for the name of God. Sincerity cannot be questioned. And yet, at that same moment, he turns to his community and says, despite my sincerity, despite my commitment to Judaism, despite the fact that I'm not even a first generation, I'm a second generation convert, you've rejected me, and look, that was wrong, because I really am a member of the Jewish people. And Reiner notes that what seems to be lurking in the background here was a discomfort in the community with converts, a discomfort with the notion of conversion, of having converts in the community, such that it was felt by even the most sincere of converts of that period. So the question that I want to explore is whether, right, historically, in whether it be the period of the Talmud, whether it be the medieval period, right, was this the norm? Right, were communities hesitant of converts, of conversion? Or did they embrace it? And the answer, which shouldn't surprise people, is going to be mixed. Right? It's going to be mixed. But mixed, not just, it's mixed really going back to the period of the Talmud, and that's what I want to explore a little bit. So if we start now looking to the sources, we look at source 2. Here we have a Midrash Tanchuma. Okay? So the Midrash goes as follows. Reish Lakish said, "He who is converts," okay, that's a bad translation, "he who converts is more beloved than Israel when they stood at Mount Sinai. Why? For if the Jews had not seen thunder and lightning, trembling mountains and shofar blasts, they never would have accepted the Torah. Yet this convert, who never saw any of those things, came and fully dedicated himself to God and accepted the yoke of heaven. Could there be anyone more beloved than that?" So the Midrash undeniably loves converts, right? Jews, right? We read in the Torah that nation, the formative years of the nation when we left Egypt, the amount of grief we caused despite the fact that we'd seen the miracles in Egypt and we'd seen the revelation of God, we only accepted the Torah because there was fire and lightning and clouds and shofar blasts and all that, right, pyrotechnics going on there at Har Sinai. And even there, we weren't exactly the most committed of people, right? Whether it's, you know, a minute before the revelation at Sinai or the week before, we're complaining about water, and then we're complaining about food, and then we're complaining about water again, and then we do it again, right? We send the spies, we worship the golden calf, right? And these were people who saw the miracles, and here you have a convert who, no fire, no lightning, no miracles, he's converted, he's sincere. How much more could you possibly want? And the Midrash says clearly, we love Gerim. Okay. Now, this doesn't necessarily say that we look to proselytize, or we look to convert. It just means that if someone does convert, we hold him to a very high standard. But you would think that if this is the view of converts that you have, once they did come into the people, you wouldn't have the reaction that you have of this Yaakov ben Sulam, that all you've done is disgrace me, right? They'd hold him on a pedestal. Now, what's interesting, and here we're going to do a little bit of his intellectual history of the medieval period and try to trace what's actually going on. So, the first source, we're describing the 11th century, 1096, France, Germany, well, Germany, really. Okay? So now this Midrash should prove nothing about what the community is actually doing, because the Midrash is written hundreds of years before that. Except that the Midrash is cited by Rav Moshe of Kusi in his Sefer Mitzvot Gdolot. Rav Moshe of Kusi is a German rabbi who lived, as I put in the brackets over here, from the year 1200 to 1260. He cites the Midrash and he adds one word. It says, Hagerim Shebiyamenu. The converts in our days are beloved, and then he cites the Midrash. So, in 1096, in Mainz, and then again in Xanten, you have these nameless convert in Xanten, and you have the named convert who says the Jewish community rejects him. And this is the end of the 11th century. And 104 to 100 and... 64 years later, somewhere in between, presumably not 104, if when he was born he came out with his magnum opus, that would be very impressive, presumably a little bit later in life. But okay, 150 years later, whatever it might be, you have Rav Moshe of Kusi saying that converts are the best, they're better than we are. So what happened that we went from 1096, where this convert who's giving up his life is saying the community has rejected me, to Rav Moshe of Kusi 100 plus years later saying that the way we relate to converts is with this backdrop of the Midrash? And you already start to see that there was a tension, right? In the 11th century, there seems to be a hesitation about converts, even the most sincere. And then by the 13th century, Rav Moshe of Kusi is holding them up on a pedestal. Okay. But let's look now at the Talmud, because the Talmud also is ambivalent. This Midrash is not ambivalent, but the Talmud is ambivalent. So if you look at Source 3, a very famous series of Gemara. So the Gemara says as follows. On another occasion it happened that a certain heathen came before Shammai, and he said to him, make me a proselyte on condition that you teach me the whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Right? A famous story. Shammai says to him, before I even read it, Shammai says to him, get out of here, right? Right, get out. Or I can barely give one topic. Right? If I try giving this one lecture on one aspect of one topic on one foot, I would last. I don't know how long it would last. I don't want to experiment. But I would not last to teach the entirety of the corpus of Torah. I mean, even if I just went to the shelf, just the Talmud, right? I have to read through this shelf on one foot. I can barely take down all the books from the shelf on one foot. And here he's asking him to teach the entire Torah on one foot. He says, get out of here. You're not sincere. He throws him out. Thereupon he repulsed him with the builder's cubit, which was in his hand. When he came before Hillel, he said to him, fine, I'll do it. Picks up one foot, What is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the whole Torah, while the rest is commentary thereof. Go and learn it. Puts down his foot, and that's the end of that story. So Hillel accepts him as a convert, and he finds a way of encouraging him. Parenthetically, this line by Hillel is often miscited, because this line is often cited that what is hateful to you, don't do to others. That is the entire Torah, and the rest is commentary. Right? That's where it ends. Right? But that's not the end of Hillel's statement. The rest of the commentary, go and learn it. Right? He wasn't actually letting him off the hook. He wasn't saying everything else isn't important. He was saying that this line really does sum up the whole Torah, but if you want to understand how it summarizes the whole Torah, you have to go and study. Rashi over there notes that your friend can refer either to people or to God, because God is also referred to in different places as your friend. And therefore it encompasses both aspects. It's what you wouldn't like to do, what you wouldn't like done to you, don't do to others, and what the way you wouldn't want to be treated, don't treat God. So if you owe something to God, you owe him gratitude, so you have to show him that gratitude. But what does that mean? Well, go look what he says it means. When we say, don't do anything to other people that they wouldn't like, well, what does that mean? That means a lot of things. Go understand it. Right, so Hillel isn't quite letting him off the hook. He's not saying, forget all the mitzvah, they're not important. He's just saying, here, I'll give you the one-line summary, but if you really want to understand how all of Judaism is really a manifestation of that principle, then you have to go study it. Right? He's not letting him off the hook. Okay, close parentheses. But at any rate, he gives him a way in. Even though the guy has quite the gall, right, quite the temerity to ask him to teach the Torah on one foot, he finds a way of warmly accepting him. And I'm sure the guy actually then went and read, because if someone's willing to, you know, put up with your shtick, right, pick up his foot and tell you the one-liner that summarizes it, and he's willing to think of that on the spot, you're at least going to give him a chance. And then we get another story, Hillel and Shammai again, another occasion. It happened that a certain heathen was passing behind a Beit Midrash where he heard the voice of a teacher reciting, and these are the garments which they shall make. And he heard them reciting the passage about the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. So a breastplate, an ephod. So he comes in, he says, this sounds really nice. Right? I would love to have the choshen, right, a breastplate with 12 gemstones on it, right, engraved with the names of the tribes. It sounds very regal. Right? It's the crown jewels, just not on a crown, right? It's here, so everyone can see them. So he says, for whom are these? So he says, for the high priest, he was told. Then said that heathen to himself, I will go and become a proselyte, that I may be appointed a high priest. So went before Shammai and said to him, make me a proselyte on condition that you appoint me a high priest. Shammai said, really? Really? But he repulsed him with the builder's cubit, which was in his hand. He then went before Hillel, who made him a proselyte. Said he to him, right, so Hillel accepted him. Now this is even more striking than the first one, because the first one, he said, teach me the whole Torah on one foot, and then I'll come. Here, said, make me a Kohen Gadol. The first one, he came up with some clever way. The second one already, there's a problem, because can the convert be a Kohen Gadol? No, right? Most Jews cannot be the Kohen Gadol. They need to be a Kohen, and for sure, a convert, since right tribal identity goes by the father, right? He's not Jewish. It's not happening. And yet he converts him, and we'll see. I didn't put it actually on. But Tosfot here asked the obvious question, which is I don't understand. One rule that everyone agrees to, regardless of what level of sincerity you think a convert needs, the one thing that cannot happen is he can't say I'm converting on condition that I violate even a single mitzvah. Right? We can say that, look, nobody's perfect, so you don't have to actually achieve perfection, but you can't off the bat say, look, I really like gossiping, so I'm not even going to accept that command, right? Everyone gossips. That's understandable, and the convert presumably will as well. But if he said, I'm converting on condition that I'm allowed to gossip and you'll never call me out on it, we wouldn't convert him. So he says, I don't understand. How could you convert him in this circumstance? So Tosfot says, based on the following lines, which we'll see in just a second, that he knew that this convert would in the end come round and commit to all the mitzvot with full sincerity. So that becomes a very important comment of Tosfot in modern conversion psak and modern conversion policy, right? The question of to what extent can you make assumptions like that, that he will become sincere or he will commit to more than he or she may be committed to now. But now returning to our story with that as background, so he comes to Hillel and Hillel converts him. But now the problem is the convert wants to be the Kohen Gadol. So Hillel has to not just tell him, just kidding, or you can't be a Kohen Gadol. He now has to show him why it's okay that he's not the Kohen Gadol. So he says to him, can any man be made a king but he who knows the arts of government? Do you go and study the arts of government? He went and read. So he said, look, you want to be the high priest, you got to learn about it. If you wanted to be king, you wanted to be the president, the prime minister, you need to at least study politics. So go, at least study what it means. Okay, so he goes. So he goes and he learns about kingship. And when he came to, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death, he asked, to whom does this verse apply? So he came to one of the verses about entering the Mishkan, or the Mikdash, entering the temple, which says, any stranger who comes to the Mishkan or the Mikdash will be put to death. So he said, who does that apply to? He says, even to David, king of Israel. So thereupon, the proselyte reasoned within himself, a fortiori, if Israel, who are called sons of the omnipresent, and who in his love for them, he designated them, Israel is my son, my firstborn, yet is written of them, and the stranger shall cometh nigh, shall be put to death, how much more so, mere proselyte who comes with his staff and wallet. So he says, look, you know what? I'm giving it up, because if even the Jews, even the king of the Jews, born Jew, right? He's not like he's coming in, even a born Jew, even the king, even someone who clearly Judaism respects, can't come into the sacred parts of the temple, then it's not insulting to me as a convert that I can't be the Kohen Gadol, neither can the king. If the king can't, then I can live with the fact that I can't, right? It's not such an insult. So then he goes, yeah.
What does a
fortiori
mean?
No, a fortiori means, in Hebrew it would be kal vachomer, but it means, right, you make an argument from, right, if it's true of the lesser one, for true of the more severe one. But I don't think there is an English word, so the English word is the Latin word, which is a fortiori. Whatever it is, right, it's the form of argument that goes, if my three-year-old son can pick up an apple, then I can pick up an apple, right? That's the form of argument. Okay. So then the convert goes to Shammai. And he said to him, am I then eligible to be high priest? It is not written in the Torah, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. And he went before Hillel and said to him, O gentle Hillel, blessings rest on thy head for bringing me under the wings of the Shekhinah. Sometime later the three, I only put two of the stories, but there were three, later the three met in one place and they said, Shammai's impatience sought to drive us from the world, but Hillel's gentleness brought us under the wings of the Shekhinah. So here already in the Talmud you seem to have, I don't know if it's a tension, meaning it's a tension in the sense there's more than one opinion, but it doesn't seem to be one person torn. There seems to be different approaches. There's Shammai's approach, which pushes converts away. And then there's Hillel's approach to bring them closer. Now, the conclusion of the Talmud is, yeah?
He said there's three stories. Is that where we learn the three times asking?
No, it just happens to seem to be three stories. We learn the three from Ruth. Right, exactly. It could be that, literally it's alluding to that. I'm not sure. Okay. So you have already in the Talmud, you have two traditions. You have that of Hillel and that of Shammai. Shammai, which is less into accepting converts, he wants... Now, this doesn't mean that if someone came to him with full sincerity, he'd push him away. It just means he's not looking to make them sincere. Right? They come, they seem not sincere, he doesn't do much investigating. He said, okay, I don't need you. What would have happened if someone said, look, I want to be a convert, and I'm willing to put in the time and the years and the commitment, I assume Shammai also would have said, I can work with you. But Shammai is clearly a less accepting perspective or a less inviting perspective to converts. Again, he's not, I assume, a wholly committed convert who wasn't in one of these middle situations. Shammai wouldn't have pushed him away, but Shammai isn't looking for converts, so unless someone can prove his absolute sincerity, Shammai says, thank you, but no thank you. Hillel, even when he sees a spark, he sees a spark, a possible sincere convert, he says, okay, I'm willing to work with you. So you already see a perspective that yes, we not just will tolerate a convert or will accept a convert who's perfect, but you know what? Conversion is an important enough thing that even if I see that spark of hope, I'm willing to work with them. So you already see that perspective amongst these different voices in the, this is already the Tannaitic period. In the Amoraic period, the period of the Talmud itself, you also have different voices. And what we're going to see now is a few passages that seem to be very hesitant about conversions, even very negative about converts. But what I want to do is do a little bit of a history lesson and watch how these passages in the Talmud transformed or shifted in interpretation over the course of a few hundred years, to show how even those lines that seem to point in one direction are ambiguous enough that that same tension, are we in favor or against, depending on your perspective, we will reinterpret those same lines to fit the different narratives. So if you look in source 4, okay, this one's going to be a little bit of a disturbing source, and then we're going to move to interpreting it. So the Talmud in Kiddushin 70b says as follows. Rav Chama bar Chanina said, when the Holy One, blessed be He, causes His divine presence to rest, it is only upon families of pure birth in Israel. Rav Chelbo said, proselytes are as injurious to Israel as a scab. For it is said, and the stranger shall join himself with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob. Here it is written, v'nispichu, while elsewhere it is written, and this is the context of the law for all the manners of the plagues of leprosy, and for a rising and for a scab, sapachat. So the word in the context of conversion is v'nispichu, which we connect to the word in the context of leprosy, sapachat, and we say converts are to the Jewish people like a scab, like a leprous scab. Okay, so now, our question, do we want converts? Not. This passage in the Talmud, very, very negative. Which leads to at least a six-way dispute in the Tosafist, in the medieval period, right? We're focusing here a little bit on medieval Ashkenaz, France and Germany. How do we understand that line? And what I want you to pay attention to closely, not just the positions, but I want you to pay attention to years. I've bracketed them all. As we go through the authors, I want you to pay attention to the years in which each of the positions are written. So a little bit of background here. Tosafot, right? If you open a page of Talmud, so on one side of the page you have Rashi, right? Rav Shlomo ben Yitzchak, Rav Shlomo Yitzchaki, 1040 to 1105. On the other side of the page, you have, right, he lives in France, and then the other side of the page, you have Tosfot. Now, who are Tosfot? So this is a really complicated question. Tosfot refers vaguely to a group of 150 or so rabbis over the course of 200 years in France and Germany. Okay? Who wrote the Tosfot, what we call Tosfot Shelanu, the Tosfot on the page of the Talmud? Also a complicated question, and it depends on the tractate. Many of them were written by Relazar of Tuk. Many of them were written by some of the German Balei Tosfot. But basically, the Tosfot that we have on the side of our page is a compilation, a relatively late compilation of Tosafist material. So, sometimes you'll have in Tosfot just the big names, right? When I took a course on the Tosafot in graduate school, so the professor, Ephraim Kanterfogel, liked saying that in the Tosafot period, right, you have, and I'm not enough of a baseball maven to fully understand it, but he had the Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Lou Gehrig of the Balei HaTosfot, which were Isaac of Dampier, Rabbeinu Tam, right, Jacob Tam, right, because Jacob is called Tam in the Torah, right, and Rav Shimon of Shantz, Rav Shimon of Sens. So those are the people who get quoted a lot, and then you have a lot of people who are quoted once in a while, more or less. But the Tosfot on our page is a late compilation, so you get a cross-section of several hundred years of rabbis, often from both France and Germany. Academic scholars of Tosfot, if you want to try to trace an idea, you have to pay attention to who's talking, which you don't always know who's talking, but sometimes you can figure out who's talking, sometimes there's an name, sometimes there isn't, and then you can trace an idea over generations. So we're going to see a Tosfot on this line, which presents six positions spanning 200 years. Okay? So source five. So first they cite Rashi. Rashi, again, the primary commentator on the Talmud, 1040, 1105, France. But he, in turn, is citing his teacher, Rabbi Yosef ben Yakar. So now we're back in the 10th century. He lives 990 to 1064. So he explained, why are converts like a scab? This is because they are not punctilious in observance, and thus bring calamities, and furthermore, Jews learn from their ways. So first position of Rashi. What does it mean? Converts are like a sapachat, are like a scab. Exactly what it sounds like. We don't want them because they don't do mitzvot carefully, and therefore born Jews learn from them. It's a bad situation. We don't want them. In 2, again, Rashi, in a different place, Rashi has various explanations. He says, some explain that all Jews are guarantors for one another. Kol Yisrael arevim zeh bazeh zeh lazeh. So, building on the last one, he says, maybe the problem isn't just that we learn from them, but that we're guarantors from one another, which the Talmud understands to mean that when one person sins, we can all be punished, because it's our responsibility to make sure that everyone is the best person they can be. So since converts aren't punctilious, they aren't careful about mitzvot, everyone else is going to get punished, not just because they're going to learn, even if they don't learn from them, the fact that they couldn't stop them from violating the law is a problem. But that is not right. Now, if we stop there, but that is not right, why is that not right? Why would you say that's not right? You could have said, right, why is it not true that we'll be punished for the convert's sins? What?
We're all responsible for our own actions.
Well, right, but assuming the principle of the Talmud, Kol Yisrael arevim zeh bazeh, that we're actually responsible for everyone, right? So the simplest answer would be, I reject the assumption that they're not keeping the mitzvot, right? Who said they're not keeping mitzvot? That's not what he says. He says it's not right because since Israel was not made a guarantor for converts when accepting the Torah, not true. We are responsible for everyone else, just not for converts. Okay? So here we have two positions. Late 10th century, 11th century. What's the position that emerges of converts? Right? Don't really want them. They don't keep the mitzvot carefully. Okay. Next explanation, number 3. Some explain that converts are as difficult as a scab because the Holy One, blessed be He, commanded us in 24 places not to oppress them, and it is impossible not to cause them pain. Okay, radically different explanation. What does this position say? Why are they like a scab? Because we don't want them? No, we do want them, but we don't know how to treat them. Right, God really, really, really cares how you treat the convert. And Jews aren't so great at treating converts all the time. So it's not that we don't want them. We would love to have them. But realistically, we're not going to treat them right. So it's going to be bad for us. So this perspective, right, pro or against? Pro converts. But if we then asked, okay, but what's the reality on the ground that this author is seeing? Negative, right? So there's a little bit of ambivalence. He's saying, ideally, pro. Realistically, we're not so good at it, right? There's a opposition on the ground. Okay, four. What? Like the first example, right? This is not coming in a vacuum. That's why I started with that story. Okay, four. Some explain that because of the converts, Israel is in exile. As it says, why are Israel scattered throughout the world more than other idolatrous nations? So that converts will be added to them. Fourth explanation. There's a Talmudic passage that says the reason we went into Galut, that we went into exile, was so that converts would be joined to the Jewish people. Pro or con? Well, again, pro in the sense that ideologically it says we want converts. Negative in the sense that we want converts, but the price we have to pay for that is a high price. So, ideally, we would love them, but it costs us a lot to have the belief that we want converts. So yet again, a second explanation which idealizes converts while recognizing a cost on the ground.
Excuse me, what about the masses that came out of Egypt? Did they receive the Torah at Mount Sinai?
Oh, like the yes. I mean, they did. Anyone who was at...
No, there was a group...
The Erev Rav, right? Yes, presumably they were there, but they're a interesting case, because they accepted the Torah with us, but, you know, caused us a lot of trouble, even more trouble than, you know, the rest of the Jews in the, right, so that's already, you know, an interesting case where, you know, they sort of became a Jewish people with us, but never fully integrated in a positive way. From the Torah, I mean, the description of the Erev Rav that was amongst them. And definitely the Midrashic understanding is that they were often the ones causing all the problems in the nation. But yes, right, that's an interesting sort of early case of conversion. The Talmud even there, the Midrashim even have a conversation between God and Moshe where God says, look, don't bring them with you. And Moshe says, no, I want to. So God says, okay, you can bring them, but trust me, you don't want to. And you'll see. You'll see why, and then goes on. So there, even within the Talmud, there is this interesting, and the Midrashim, this interesting ambivalence about that early generation of converts, so to speak. Okay, but then the Tosfot, the anonymous voice here says, but that seems wrong, because the Talmud says that when a Gentile comes to convert, we say, why do you want to convert? You should know how poor and oppressed Jews are so that they will be dissuaded, which is explained with the statement that converts are terrible for Israel. So we see that they are difficult after their conversion. But this position says, no, I don't like that because that implies that converts are only bad before they convert. Right? It's bad that we're here to attract them, but not that once they're part of us, it's a problem. But this anonymous voice asserts, no, it's a problem even after they convert. So moves back to the negative. Okay. Then in 5, we get a surprise. We get a not often quoted Bala Tosfot named Rabbi Avraham Hager. Right? Avram the convert. So you just imagine the scene. Right? There's this conversation going on in the Beit Midrash of the Balei HaTosafot. Converts are like scabs. Some say because you don't keep mitzvot very well. Some say because we're not responsible for you. Some say, you know, we would want you, but we don't know how to treat you. Right? Some say it's because we don't really want to be here to attract you. And then you have this sincere convert who is not just a convert, but has entered the Tosafist Academy. He's a scholar, he's committed, and he's listening, and he's like, really? Really? I have a different interpretation for you. Converts are scrupulous and meticulous in their observance, and thus are difficult as Israel as a scab, for Israel as a scab, because God is reminded of Israel's sins. You know why you don't want us? Because we're better than you. Right? If you remember that Midrash Tanchuma, though, that's exactly what the Smag said. Right? By the 13th century, a non-converted rabbi is saying the same thing, that converts are more beloved than Jews, because they don't need all the miracles to enter the Jewish people. And here you have Avram Hager saying the reason the Talmud says converts are like scabs is not because you don't want them, but because it makes you guys look bad. Because here we are, we entered of our own volition, and we can do this better than you because we're more committed. You, right? I'm a Jew by choice. You're not. And the fact that I'm by choice imbues what I do with a meaning that you apparently don't have. And then we get a sixth position. Rav Yitzchak of Dampir, right here we're in our top three Balei HaTosfot, 1115 to 1184, explained that they are terrible because they get absorbed into the Jewish people and the divine presence dwells on families of perfect lineage. And this seems right because Rav Chelbo is cited in proximity to Rav Chama Bar Chanina. He says it's a technical point, or not so technical. He says it's a problem because the Shechina, the divine presence, dwells on families which are of pure lineage. Positive, negative, negative, but not, let's say, as negative as Rashi, right? He's not saying they're bad, they don't keep mitzvah. He's just saying that there's some metaphysical sense in which the Shechina rests on mishpachot miyuchasot. So here you have this, what seems like a very negative statement in the Talmud about conversion, but you get the range in the medieval period, whether that means because converts don't keep the mitzvah well or we're not responsible for them, to converts are better than you, and therefore they make you look bad, to middle positions, which are we really like converts, but we don't know how to take care of them, or we like converts, but because we like converts so much, God made us go into exile to bring them to us, so it's come at a cost. So you have positive, negative, and somewhere in between ambivalent positions. You have a range over the course of this 200 years of to what extent do we really want to embrace them. If we continue, however, at first when we look at this Tosfot, it just seems that this is just a replay on a different level of the Talmud. Because in the Talmud, you had Hillel, who was more accepting, and Shammai, who was less accepting. Okay. So you have this Talmudic passage, which seems negative, but you have the voice, there are different rabbinic voices. Some are more positive, some are less positive. It's natural. There's a tension. How much do we want converts? How much do we not want converts? And that's one way of looking at it, that this is just a perpetual dispute. And we'll see next week that there are some who say this. We'll see next week a piece from Chaim David Halevi, the former chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, who says that in fact, yes, there is a constant dispute, a constant tension. And he argues that the reason there is no explicit command in the Torah to convert people is because God wanted to leave it a little bit ambiguous, because he said there is an ambiguity. Sometimes it's a good time to have more converts, sometimes less. Different people have different tendencies, and the whole range of positive, negative positions is basically, yeah, there's a range, and that's okay, and you see a range, that's what there is. And therefore, if people are doing it, right, if people with integrity think we should be more welcoming, good. If they think we should be less welcoming, also legitimate. Right, so that's one way of looking at it. But there is another one, and here we have to be sensitive to history. But before we're sensitive to history, let's read a few more sources. Okay? So, Talmud in source 6. That those who receive proselytes bring evil upon themselves is deduced in accordance with the statement of Rabbi Chelbo, for Rabbi Chelbo stated, proselytes are hurtful to Israel as a sore on the skin. Again, the same notion, but here that right, they're like a scab, they're a sore. But this is now included in the question of it was directly tied to the question of do we receive them, do we accept converts? And here the Talmud says no, don't accept them because they're like a scab. So if you read that straight, this would be an even more direct evidence from the Talmud. We don't want them. It's not just that they're bad, but we don't accept them because we don't want them. We try not to. But in 7, Tosfot clarifies, the Ri of Dampir says, no, this is when we push them to convert or accept them immediately. It's bad to go out, look for them, drag them in, or when they come to convert, let them in immediately. If, however, they put forth effort to convert, we should accept them. For we have seen that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were punished for not accepting Timna, referring to a Midrashic story of a woman who really wanted to enter the Jewish people, and they didn't. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov didn't manage to bring her in, so she ended up marrying into one of the children of the Abrahamic family, but not the Jewish side of it. And he says further, and Hillel converted, as we saw in number 3, even though they were not putting in the effort to convert, Hillel knew that in the end they would convert fully, as they did in the end, as we mentioned this position of Tosfot. So the Re clarifies, he says, no. I know the Talmud sounds like we don't want converts, but it's not true. We don't want insincere converts. So when we say that converts are like a scab, we mean the converts that are rushed in. But if someone is either comes with full commitment, or even in the case of Hillel, you see that spark and you know they will be committed, so then they're not a scab, they're good. It's a certain type of convert, the insincere convert, who is rushed in that we oppose. But fundamentally, we really do want converts, we really like converts, they're great. Okay. One more dispute. We mentioned this from Rambam last week, but now let's see it from the original sources. The Mishnah on Bikurim has the following discussion. So Bikurim, the offering of the first fruits. So each year, as your first fruits develop, you take them in a basket, you bring them to the temple, you say a whole few psukim, which we say at the Seder, right? My father was a wandering Aramean, etc. And now you've brought me to this place, and you have this whole ceremony. One of the things you say is that you've brought us to the land that that was promised to our ancestors. So the Mishnah records a dispute. Can a convert bring the Bikurim, bring the first fruits, and say that passage that you gave this land to my forefathers? Problem being, forefathers, right? He's not a born Jew. So the Mishnah says as follows. These may bring Bikurim, but do not recite the Torah portion read when bringing Bikurim. The ger may bring, but does not recite, because he cannot say which God has sworn to our ancestors to give unto us. But if his mother were an Israelite, he may bring and recite. And when he prays privately, he says, O God of the ancestors of Israel, even in his private prayers, he doesn't say, Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu, our God and the God of our forefathers. He says, our God, the Father, the God of the fathers of Israel, leaving himself out. And when he is in the synagogue, he says, O God of your ancestors, right? If he's davening as the Chazan, so then he says, the God of your ancestors. And if his mother were an Israelite, he may say, O God of our ancestors. So the Mishnah records a position that the convert is never allowed to say that he is the child of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. So the Yerushalmi pushes back. The Yerushalmi cites a different Tannaitic position and says, it was taught in the name of Rabbi Yehuda that a convert himself brings and reads, why? For I have given you, Avraham, as the father of multitudes of nations, Avhamon Goyim. In the past you were the father of Aram, now are you the father of all nations. And Rabbi Shua ben Levi says, the law is like Rabbi Yehuda. And a case came before Rabbi Abahu, and he ruled like Rabbi Yehuda. So the Yerushalmi cites a disagreeing position and rules like it. The Rabbi Yehuda says, no, a convert is part of the family. He's a child of Avram, period, end of story, and he can say it, no problem. Okay, so how do we rule? So, Rabbeinu Tam, in the context of Birkat HaMazon and Grace After Meals, says, I rule like the Mishnah, he can't say it. He can't say that he is the child of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But Isaac of Dampier says, of course he can. We rule like the Yerushalmi. And so do his German contemporaries, Rav Yoel HaLevi of Bonn, Rav Elazar bar Natan, Rav Elazar bar Yoel HaLevi, Rav Elazar of Worms, and as we saw last week, the Rambam as well, in his letter to Ovadia Hager, right, Ovadia the convert, said the same thing. You are a child of Avram, no problem. Okay, so now you have yet another dispute, right? Is the convert really part of the family or not? And again, we could chalk it up to the fact there are different voices, there's a dispute, fine. But Rami Reiner, in that same article that we opened with, notes that if we look at this with a little bit of a historical lens, something fascinating will emerge. He says, let's try lining up the positions. Okay, 10th century, Rav Yosef ben Yakar, cited by Rashi in the 11th century, says, why don't we like converts? Because they're not punctilious. Negative, positive. Unequivocally, negative. Okay. Rashi himself, also negative. The anonymous voices, as we noted, which are presumably after that, we just don't know exactly when. Positive, negative. Somewhere in between. The Re, writing in the 12th century, 1115, 1184, and his contemporaries, who say, of course you're a member of the, right, the family of Avram. Positive or negative? Positive. And Tosfot in 7, right, the Rav Yitzchak of Dampir, that, again, the same, that same Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Dampir, who says that the line that says like a scab is only converts who are rushed in but aren't sincere. Positive or negative? Positive. Positive. He's saying only ones who aren't sincere like a scab. But if you you vetted them, right? If you didn't drag them kicking and screaming as converts, and they came of their own accord, of course we want them. Of course that's good. Rabbeinu Tam, is 1100 to 1171, who says they can't say Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoseinu. Negative, or somewhere negative, right? So he says, if you actually just put it on a timeline, the earlier sources, negative. Middle sources, a little bit more ambivalent, moving to positive. And then he says, I have a source from a little bit later, latter half of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century, in 11, from a mayor of Rothenburg, citing Rabbi Yehuda Chassid in Germany, saying as follows, the son of David, meaning the Mashiach, the Messiah, does not arrive before all souls expire in the body. This is an idea from the Talmud that there are a number of souls up in heaven and all of them need to be born before Mashiach comes. Okay, so there's a chamber in the heavens called Guf, this body, housing all souls destined to enter humans, and an angel appointed to oversee pregnancies takes souls from that chamber and implants them in women's bellies. Occasionally, the angel errs and places a soul worthy of a Gentile in a Jewish woman's intestines, and her baby becomes a meshumad, an apostate. And occasionally, he places a soul worthy of a Jew in a Gentile woman's intestines, and her baby becomes a ger. So, without leaving the mysticism, with leaving aside the mysticism, I don't really know what's going on, but he said, what emerges from this text in the latter half of the 12th century in Germany? How does Rabbi Yehuda Chassid view converts? And it's cited again by Rabbi Meir Rothenberg a little bit later in the 13th century. They were really Jews. Right? If he's a convert, he was always a Jew. He was a Jewish soul hidden in a non-Jewish body. So Rami Reiner says, you know what I think is happening? It's not just that there's positive voices and negative voices. There was actually development over the medieval period, that you went from early positions in the 11th century saying, we don't want converts, they don't keep mitzvah, they're not punctilious, why would we want them? To people saying in the 13th century, not only do we want them, they're basically Jews that we've lost. They're our lost family, they're the trapped souls in non-Jewish bodies. And he said, but he says why? He doesn't think it's random. And here I think it puts an important light on it. Because as we noted, I think it's fair to say that there's different voices and that we tend to find more positive voices amongst discussions of sincere converts and more negative voices when the assumption is converts are not sincere. But he says, you know what? I think that there was actually a reason historically for why people viewed it this way. But he said, wait a second, when's Rashi writing? Pre-Crusades. So things are pretty good. So when things are pretty good, converts might join because things are pretty good. So you might get people who aren't so careful. In the 11th century, we saw the types of convert you had in the 11th century. No one wanted to be a Jew in 1096. And if you did, you were like Yaakov Bar Sulam. You might be martyred along with the Jewish people. If you start seeing those converts, those types of converts, right? That's amazing. And if you've had 100 years of this by the 13th century, where you've seen crusade after crusade, and you've seen people, despite the fact that it's so hard to be a Jew, entering, and you no longer remember the good times when converts didn't want to come, right? What you've seen is sincere converts. So what is your opinion going to be of converts? They're basically Jews. Look, they're dying with us, and this has been happening for so long. So he says it's not an accident. He says, you know what? And what I would take out of it is that there is a certain level of ambivalence. We want converts or not. But I don't think it's just that some people want them and some people don't want them. Basically, everyone agrees that absolute sincere converts are amazing. And everyone agrees that insincere converts, right, we don't really want. The questions of, do we assume that people are going to be sincere? The questions of, how do, right, the normal cases, what are we going to assume? How much commitment do we expect? How much commitment do we need to see before we say, you know what, you're worth investing in? That's subject to dispute, but it's also subject to changing realities, because sometimes the situation is such that it's likely that the converts you're going to meet are more sincere and you're going to have a more positive view. If not, you might have a more negative view. There is an ambivalence, but it's not an ambivalence that exists the same at all times. You need to take the reality into account. And as reality shifts, perspectives may shift as well. And that's basically Rami Reiner's argument. That sincere converts we always wanted. Right? How much, exactly how we go about it, subject to dispute. But we have to take into account the historical realities and the reality of who are we talking about, right? Not all converts are created the same. Not all generations are created the same. We need to take into account the reality, and this is what he argues happened in the medieval period, that as converts went from being converts when things were easy to converts when things were hard, from being potentially insincere to being sincere, the community shifted along with it slowly. And that's why he said you see negative voices first, ambivalent voices, or voices that recognize we would ideally want converts, but we haven't yet learned how to deal with them. And then by the end of the century, you see voices that basically say converts are just Jews that were hidden away from us by the mistaken angel who put them in the wrong body. So you see this shift of perspectives that I think in many ways explain some of the tensions that you have. Again, there's still going to be an ambivalence. There's still different voices, but they're not necessarily as far as you might think. Yeah.
I was just saying, this is like 1,000 years ago.
Today, same story.
Right, so this is 1,000 years ago.
Okay, today is a totally different
Correct. And today is a totally different story, right? But it's helpful to see the medieval example because, especially with the historical perspective, right, and to see how changing circumstances really do affect it. And when you see the debates in Israel, right, for example, where you have some voices saying we're opposed because the people who are converting are doing it for citizenship, right, and they're not sincere, and you have others saying, but they're committed to the state of Israel, they're fighting in our wars, right, what you see is this dispute playing out. Because there's an ambivalence in the Talmud, and there's a recognition that you need some level of commitment. The question is, what type? So you have some looking at these sources and saying, look, sincere converts we want, but these aren't sincere converts. And you have other people saying, well, they're sincere in a different type of a sense because we're living in the 21st century. And you know what? They might put their lives on the line for the state. They may not be as religious as you want them to be, but they are committed. So where do they go in this equation, right? It's a different question, but in many ways, it's, right, the question will come up in every generation, and every generation will have its own struggles with conversion. So I like, and this is why I started with, why I like putting the medieval examples rather than rushing to it. Because when we look at it 1,000 years ago and their challenges were different, right, we can look at it a little bit more objectively and we can recognize why there might be ambivalence. Because we may have preconceived notions of how things should go in the 21st century. But it helps us frame the modern debate if we realize that this debate has been recurring from the Talmud in the medieval period, etc., etc., and there have been legitimate different voices in a range of them, and that realities have always changed how we relate to it. What we need to do in the 21st century is continue to struggle with how we plug in the modern reality into this historical debate. But realizing it is historical helps us broaden it and at least understand where the other side's coming from and not demonize either side so quickly, because realize there is precedent, there is reason to be on both sides of the equation, even if we might think that some of the sides went a little bit too far. Yeah.
So does that mean that in the medieval period, rabbis rejected converts from other rabbis?
So presumably not, but then again, you know, we tend to assume probably not, but the system was totally different. The number of converts were very small. And most of them, at least at different points, were sincere. I will just bracket out that one of the things which I didn't get into here to fill out the historical perspective, and this is a point made by Ephraim Kanterfogel, is that we've left out another aspect of this discussion, which is what type of text discuss conversion. And he notes that in the French Tosafists, you have discussions of, when I had a convert come to me, so this is what I did. In the German context, you really don't. And he notes that in addition to what we said here, he thinks that actually in France, there were people converting. So this was a real question. The Germans were freer to talk about in the ideal because it was illegal in Germany to convert, right, to Judaism. The question of what exactly he did is complicated by the fact, as we've noted in previous classes, there weren't so many converts, right? Even in the best of times, there weren't so many converts. It was often illegal. So the people who did make it, made it. We're dealing with a different world, right? And you know, I think looking at the historical model is helpful to frame the issues, but the modern question is still the modern question and needs to be engaged on its own terms because it really is a different world. Yeah.
These comments were...
You know, I think I'm going to stop now, and everyone wants to ask questions after.